is Steve Sherlock with another Franklin Matters radio show, number 587 in the series. This section of the radio show shares the Franklin Matters question and answer session held on July 22, 2021. The session was coordinated with Ariel Doggett of the Franklin Senior Center and conducted via Zoom. This is the audio recording of the brief presentation and then the following Q&A discussion we had. A copy of the presentation document is linked below. We did have an interruption in the recording at approximately 18 minutes or so as my network connection hung up. And Ariel provides a brief recap of what was discussed as I was trying to reconnect. The August session is scheduled for August 28, 2021, and will be hybrid. I plan on being in a room at the Senior Center. We'll make the Zoom link available for folks to participate virtually. A registration is still available through Ariel. The recording runs about 48 minutes. So let's listen to my Franklin Matters Q&A session from July 22nd, 2021.
Button. And now you've got the notification. That's one of the enhancements of Zoom over time. And I'll share my screen. I've got a little bit of a presentation to kind of give you some background. And then we can go. Where are we? No, presentation over here. Nope.
The next button over says present.
There yeah. My window with the mirrors here was interfering.
I know exactly, because mine is the same, which is why I knew it was happening.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, we will record the session audio only. So you don't worry about your video. That will not be used. We're going to use it for a podcast or internet radio. And if it fits within the time frame, so some of it may be easily fit within the 55 minutes or so. If we need to edit that for the radio, then the full version would certainly be available via podcast for those who can do the podcast. So we're all here there. In terms of some current events, this was a screen grab from the town council meeting last night. These are three folks from Dean. I don't have their names in front of me at the moment, but Dean College had been denied an all alcohol license last year. There had been a discussion at an April meeting, and then in May there was a vote that finished with 4-4 tie. Dean appealed it through to the ABCC because the rationale the town used to deny their license was effectively for competition. And that's not one of the valid reasons for refusal. So ABCC tossed it back to us. Dean came, answered questions. The vote was 7-2 to approve. So quickly, and we can certainly go into more detail, but the vote effectively helps the town and Dean. Dean had been coming in for one-day licenses, up to 30 times during the year. So it was a little bit of a workload for both signs. By doing this particular license, they can do more than 30, but they don't have to come back every time. The license is also specific to the campus center on the Dean campus and specific rooms within that. So if they still did want to use the license for another special event at a different location, they still have to come back for a one-day license. So it's a good, worthy solution. There are still some issues around it from some perspectives, but mostly because of effectively just the college climate. There are some drinking issues there, but the license is not going to resolve nor worsen those, because these are event specific. One of the events in particular I had participated in a couple of times, they have an annual series of leadership lectures where they have a noted speaker. Robert Kraft was one. Certainly everybody recognizes that name, but there's been other noted people coming in to speak on particular topics. What they've generally had is also a reception for kind of the President Rooney and some of the significant guests, et cetera. Now at the reception, they can actually offer alcohol where they couldn't before. So I think it's a valid purpose. I don't think there'll be some of the troubles and issues that some folks were fearful of, and we can go further into detail on that as we go forward. But that's a quick update that just happened last night, so that's hot news for you. The other piece that was the major piece on the agenda has been the talk of the Maple Hill property, which could have been 50 to 60 homes built on some nice land along Maple Street. The town, because it was Chapter 60, 61, had a right of first refusal, all prior rights of first refusal. The town had not been able to execute. Historically, this is the first one. And because the town had passed the Community Preservation Act last November, we have the wherewithal to borrow some money from that, as well as use the money that were when we sold the old sewer beds for the property along Pond Street. There was about $1.6 million from that. It's going to get rolled into this. So effectively, we gave up some sewer beds and got some better land. And that's a good deal. One of the questions that the community prompted me for in advance of this meeting was, what's the latest with the conservation work at Delcart? I had talked with the agent back in January, and I had the link in the presentation, which I'll share, to that audio file, which did discuss their mitigations. If you had been there, excuse me, you would have noticed a growth of some invasive species along the surface of the water. They had taken some mitigation steps, some treatments, and they're continuing to monitor it. As of this point, I don't have what the current status is, but I'll be reaching out to Jen and likely do an update so everybody will get aware of that. Here's my mouse. Okay. Current event last week, because of the coming out of the pandemic status, the Historical Museum downtown had a reopening ceremony for two reasons. One, to acknowledge that they are now open also on Thursday nights, Saturday mornings, and Sunday afternoons. And two, they also revealed in a new exhibit for Davis Thayer, showing, you know, school facts, school history, photos over the years, et cetera. It's a quite extensive collection around Davis Thayer. And for those who have been around for a bit, the school committee did determined to close Davis Thayer as a school. So in September, when school opens, those who had been going to Davis Thayer will now go to the Keller Elementary School. The specific turnover of the building to the town has not yet formally happened. The school committee still has to vote to do that. And they're holding on to the building because they still have to go through and assess all the equipment, all the desks, all the school materials, et cetera. Move what they need either to Keller and or to elsewhere, salvage what they need, and then, you know, leave it in a better empty condition, if you will, for the town then to determine what they're going to need to do with it. So it was a nice day, albeit warm, and the ribbon was cut, and you can see just ended up after it was cut in the photo. Friendly reminder that on Fridays, Concerts on the Common will be filling the stage. It's rather empty at the moment, but also on the Common on Fridays from 2 to 6 is the farmer's market. I've been fortunate to be there on several Fridays, and it's a lively happening place. There's more vendors this time around than ever before, and a lot of folks are able to get, whether it's fresh bread, La Cantina, a local winery has a place. There's herbs, there's flowers, there's fresh fruits and vegetables. I think, Gary, you mentioned I haven't had a chance to go yet and get the, what was it, the whipped maple syrup you mentioned? That sounds delightful. I want to go try that. I just haven't had the opportunity to stop by that one yet, but that's on my list of things to do. Later in June, or early in June, I forget exactly when it was. This is a shot of the control panel in the new water treatment plant along Grove Street. So if you've been to the Grove Street parking lot for the SNET trail, there was some construction there for the past year and a half or so. They had an open house facility. I managed to get in. I included the photo here because as a tease, I did speak with the assistant supervisor and the water superintendent. So there'll be a series of three podcasts coming that'll talk through the water process, what all they do from a well to treat the water until it comes to we turn the tap and we get clean water. So look out for that podcast coming. It's rather insightful. I had a good time. I learned an awful lot. Hopefully you'll learn as much or more. And they're open to do more sessions. I know we've already agreed that we want to go back to cover kind of the sewer side of the business, which can be a little dirty, but it's a good topic. And the other piece that at some point in time we'll also get into is stormwater. So I'm thankful that the folks within the town are able to collaborate in this kind of a format. So we'll be able to produce some good things that people will be able to share. And then, oh, that's what happens with water. Wow. One little side note, when they do the testing for PFAS, and you may have heard PFAS is a rather nasty chemical that's quite pervasive. But when the test is actually being done, the person who is doing the testing cannot have had a scrambled egg or anything cooked on a Teflon pan that morning, nor can he have touched Tupperware, nor can he or she have worn any water-resistant or stain-resistant clothing, because then that potentially could contaminate the test he's taken. So as I mentioned, PFAS is a chemical that is used primarily in kind of firefighting foam, but it's used extensively, Teflon, Tupperware, in a bunch of other household products, and we're using it all the time. So I hadn't realized it was that significant a thing for the testing and the testing quality. So there may be other things like that that'll come out that'll pick your ear and say, ooh, I learned something. I'm also on the future front. Our Franklin Cultural Festival will return to the Town Common September 12th. There's also going to be the return of the Harvest Festival. And I think it's the first Saturday in October with a rain date of that Sunday. So we're going to have some big events to happen coming in September and October. But as I mentioned earlier, the concerts on the Common and the farmers market certainly kind of keep us busy each Friday until we get to that time. The watch list I had published earlier, I'll kind of skip over it here because I know you've got some questions. The one other piece that I do want to talk to is now on the Franklin Matters page, and I should go back. So if you go to franklinmatters.org or franklin.news, you'll end up on this page. And you can get into any of the other Franklin Radio podcasts that are now available. So instead of just listening to the 102.9 on the radio dial, you can catch a missed episode. And there's a variety of shows, the Senior Story Hour, Chapters with Jim Derrick. There's another one, actually, Safe Coalition has a Safe Radio show. It's not listed here. More Perfect Union is a discussion around democracy and the ins and outs of some of the things. It's more political, but it's a nice, honest discussion. And then the faith-based approach, really, with a priest, a rabbi, and a minister walk into a radio station, and a wonderful discussion ensues. It's a rather a long title for a good conversation. And that's the end of the presentation. So I know you've got some questions, Michael. So,
okay. First of all, I want to congratulate you as being one of the leaders in the town. We moved in here about a year and a half or two ago. And from what I understand, this is one of the safest towns in the state of Massachusetts. Is that correct?
It is, based on the stats that whichever organization, sometimes it's all the police stats go through the state numbering and then up to the FBI database. Other agencies will then, you know, do those stats, do some analysis and publish. And Franklin has been very fortunate for a number of years to, if not be in the top 10, you know, high in that listing for a number of years. So we're fortunate.
Do you have any figures in terms of the, is it safest town as far as homicides or in what reason or lancery? I mean, what?
Yeah, primarily the major crimes. So that's one of the things where, you know, the devil's in the details. So the people who are publishing these lists, respectfully, in some cases, they're more legitimate than others. And I mean that respectfully. Some of them simply do it for kind of the link gathering. If you publish a list and show, you know, 500 cities and towns, guess how many people are going to come to your website? Everybody in those 500 communities and towns, right? So they're doing it to generate some traffic. In many cases, they're doing it with a legitimate number. In this case, you know, quote, the safety. I don't know. I think it's some 30 indices or categories of statistics that are available, but certainly the major crimes are going to be there. It'll be interesting to see, because there was one incident last year, and it's the first one in my, actually there were two incidents last year. The first in my 15 years of reporting, there was a quote hostage situation in one community or neighborhood of Franklin. And then there was also a homicide, coincidentally, two blocks from my house. How long is it going to take for those two incidents to bubble into the stats that drop us from the list? Or are they? I don't know. We'll find out. That's something we'll watch. But both of those incidents occurred last year. From what I understand, this listing is based on numbers prior to 2020. So we'll see. But otherwise, as a general rule, yeah, this is a safe town from major crime perspectives. We're not perfect, but it's a good place to live.
Thank you very much for that information. I want to ask you, while I have, I was selective in terms of my questions I wanted to ask you.
Sure.
Is, from what I understand, that this town's population has exploded quite a bit in the last number of years. What was the population 10 or 15 years ago, and what is it now?
Okay, the census 2020 data has not yet been released, so the most specific numbers I don't have, but I can certainly broadly say, I think if I recall, it was about 6,000 in 1960. There was a major boom during the 80s and another major boom in the 90s, where several developments came online during that time. The house that I live in actually was built in 86, so it was part of one of those early booms, although we came in 10 years later.
I think he froze.
I believe we're currently around 34. I'm sorry?
No, I think it's him.
Yeah. It's Steve. Yeah, he's frozen for everybody. I'll give you a quick rundown of what we covered. And Michael had asked about the population growth, and
yes.
You know, you had started off by saying about 6,000. Bob had some information that it had doubled in the, I don't remember what year he said.
But 92, it was around 16,000 when we moved here.
And then right. I Googled and found out the population in 2010 was over 31,000. And we talked a little bit about the decline in the school population now, but expecting in 5 years, the COVID babies might push those numbers back.
Yeah, there's no COVID baby boom.
There's no COVID baby boom? All right.
No. And that's a national phenomenon. It's not just a Franklin one. So I think I was starting to talk about the boom during the 80s and the boom during the 90s. Those were two major growth periods. There have been other growths. So yeah, I think it was 31,000 in 2010. We're at about 34,000-35,000 currently. And while we had been on a major trajectory, it's effectively the rate of growth has slowed significantly. The birth rate is less than two. And the birth rate less than two means effectively you're not maintaining growth. You're not maintaining stability, which is why the school committee had done a demographic study showing, to your point, Ariel, that yeah, the school population is continuing with the decline. In 2011, I think it had peaked at 6,000 students. It's under 5,000, and it's expected to bottom out at about 4,600 in the next 5 years before coming back a little to 47 and then projected to stay at 47, 48, you know, for the foreseeable future.
How much of that do you think is due to the housing crisis that we have?
I was just going to say, much of that is due to the housing. I'm a classic example, and I've said it in other places. I'm living in the Center Hall Colonial. My kids are gone. There's no place for me to appropriately downsize within Franklin to give this house to another family so that they can come and use it. I expect that, and that's not going to get resolved anytime soon. People aren't building those kinds of houses. Granted, there are some apartments. We've seen the Westerly come on. We've seen the Dean Avenue apartments come on. But the kind of, you know, senior affordable living, I don't see that on the radar at this point. So housing clearly is, and that was on the watch list. It's a big discussion. There's a housing production plan that the town by law has to update every so many years. The current version just went through for citizen comment. It's being revised and will come back to town council and planning board for approval before getting submitted to the state. That we need to pay attention to, because that outlines both the issues and the town's actions they're going to take to resolve that. And if we don't agree with those actions, then, you know, shame on us for letting them either do nothing or not do enough to resolve our overall housing. There was a talking point. Somebody who has a full-time job at Stop and Shop, one job, can't afford to live in Franklin. Just the statistics. So somebody would need to have, you know, two or three jobs. And if you talk around, a lot of the, even the single family homes, there's double incomes that are paying for those mortgages as it is. And I've seen some of the apartments, even at Dean, some of the apartment, you know, two bedroom apartment monthly rental, that's more than my mortgage. It's staggering. Without even getting into the home purchase price, which because of the pent up demand and no inventory is throwing the housing prices is skyrocketing. It's astounding.
Okay, thank you.
So bottom line, we're currently at about 34,000-35,000, currently looking at smaller growth as opposed to the rapid growth that we had seen before.
Thank you very much.
Certainly.
I wanted to ask you another question. Was the ethnic background of people in this town or in this area, is it more people coming in from other ethnic backgrounds like Indians or Asians or?
Yeah, good question. Because the major import of folks, so I think if you go back to the 40s and 50s, it was like 2,000 to 4,000 people. And then there was a, particularly during the war and just post-war, there was an influx of Irish at first and then Italian. And it was interesting. There was a housing discussion that I recorded, was recorded. I shared the audio on that so that I can include that link to send out via Ariel's News. Because it had some of that historical perspective from James Johnston, who's the town historian. While the Irish had got here and created St. Mary's, then the powers that be brought in the Italians to start using at first on the railroad labor and then other labor. And those were all contract laborers. So they had to work on that contract. They weren't able to work elsewhere until the contract expired. So it was more of an indentured servitude type piece, but that was during the 40s and 50s. And then, yes, we have pretty much stayed predominantly white Caucasian, 90%, I think, is even now, but most of the growth has been in with other Asian aspects. So whether Indian, Japanese, Hindu, things of that sort, yes.
Okay.
There's a small growth in those areas.
Yeah, I talked to a few of the locals when I go out for my walks, and I find out in conversations with certain people that have been here for a long time,
mm-hmm.
a lot of people that have come in from India.
Yes.
That there's a lot of Indian people moving in from India into this area.
Yes.
Which is interesting, you know.
Yeah. Stuff. Yeah, and there that speaks to, we've got Murchie downtown and we've got the Curry House. Those two come to mind. So we've got two Indian restaurants in this population. How did that happen? Well, certainly we've got our folks here that are looking for that and utilizing that. But then it's also in the arena of Metro West. There's people that travel to those to get that as well. So it is a significant population growing in this area.
Okay. And thank you very much for that. And then the last question I had for you is, are you going to be talking about the historical aspects of Ben Franklin and some of the history of Franklin per se, to tell us a little bit about the history of the town?
I can. I am not prepared to at the moment, but I can also point you to other sources that are probably better for that. I know Ariel has featured Alan Earls, who has also a local historian and a prolific writer. James Johnston is actually, quote, the town historian of note. And I think he's published, I think it's 5 or 6 books on the town and the history over time. Those two are good people to start with. The historical museum photo that I had shared earlier, that's open on Thursday nights from, I think it's 5 to 7, Saturday from 10 to 1, and Sunday from 1 to 4. It's staffed by volunteers, but all of them generally are Franklin residents who are wealth of info, or likewise can point you to, talk to so-and-so, talk to so-and-so, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so, and that's a free visit. I mean, they take donations, but it's free to walk in.
Thank you.
And there's always something new. As I said, they just opened the Davis Thayer exhibit. Periodically, they have other exhibits, whether it's women's dresses. Actually, in the for those who had been there before, used to walk in, the gift shop was immediately to the left. Now they've reconstructed that as a parlor from the late 1880s, 1890s, 1900s time period that had been in the Oliver Pond House. They've taken the materials and brought it in there. So you can literally step back into a parlor at the turn of the century. It's a really pretty cool space.
Thank you very much.
Sure. This is why we do this.
Yeah, I think I've actually, because I did a Zoom show on that with Jim Johnston in the parlor room.
Yes, yes, you did the video walkthrough. Yes.
Yeah, and I think I actually have the video walkthrough. So, Michael, I'll look for that and see if I can't find, if I can load it to YouTube and send you the link, because it was fascinating.
Thank you. I'm interested in that. Thank you.
And if you do put it to YouTube, let me know, because I think it was a TV production. They do work with Chris, et cetera, but I don't remember seeing a YouTube piece. But if you've got one, by all means, send it to me and I'll share.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. Steve, I wanted to ask, how many students at Davis there are affected by the building close, the school closing?
I think the current population was around 300 or so.
And Keller can
absorb. Yes. Yeah, the school department, school committee had a separate committee to look at the Davis there, because with the population decline continuing, they had done the demographic study on the one hand. They also had done a facility study, and the facility study came back merging the data and the understanding of the buildings. Potentially we could close, I'd call it 2.5, another building relatively immediately. It's a political decision, so it's not going to be done overnight, because we've got the space. Mm-hmm. And utilize one other facility to do some minor modifications and additions. And then instead of having what we did have, call it 6 elementaries, treeing to 3 middle schools to 1 high school, the part of the proposal for that study was to go 3 elementaries to 1 middle to 1 high school.
Ooh, that's a lot of kids to put together.
But if you realistically, the numbers can work. Mm-hmm. And there are some educational benefits to that. Mm-hmm. The positioning of the middle school, as proposed, if it went that way, they would use the Horace Mann Oak Street complex.
They'd have to for middle school.
But yeah. The advantage there is they're also next door to the high school. So it's a much easier transition, mm-hmm. as opposed to having the three middle schools around the city and then coming to the one high school. Now that transition would occur at the middle school and then go to the high school. You would still have three elementaries. And that's where the other discussion would be. The Remington and Jefferson combination would become Jefferson as an elementary school. They would take over, and there would have to be some redistricting. So some of the Parmenter folks would go up there. And then the question would be whether to keep Parmenter or Kennedy in large, whichever one is kept. So you'd have Keller, Parmenter, Parmenter, Kennedy, and then Keller as the three elementary schools. Mm-hmm. The school department has to put together that subcommittee to start figuring out what their future plans are going to be. It's work that's needed from a budget perspective. It won't save us a heck of a lot. Even if they did close two more schools, that's only about $2 million roughly. We've got bigger budget issues than that.
How many teachers did they lose by closing David there?
It was minimal, from what I understood. Most of the teachers were going to be able to move with. There was some, if you will, central office. So they had an interim principal. He was only here for the year, so we saved on that. The assistant principal, I'm not sure what that exact status is, because some of the people. The hard part was, and it's not so much that we don't have a number. They will have a number, but it was going to be taking time because also we were coming out of the pandemic. You also had a virtual academy that had started up with some staff. And now in September, virtual goes away. Everybody's going to be coming back, but who's coming back? Who's leaving? Who's leaving of a normal course? Because people do retire anyway. Other health issues, people may change. I mean, life just continuing to happen other than, you know, being really thrown into the pandemic world of it is. So there's a whole lot of moving parts, and, you know, the dust will settle. There were certainly no major notifications to teachers that, you know, there was, because of budget cuts, nobody's coming back. There were individual pieces where, and it's a systemic thing. So for those who are not aware, a teacher gets a provisional license, and then within 3 years, continuing education and experience, then can get a permanent status at the end of the 3 years. So what many towns do is they'll use the first 2 years as kind of an evaluation. And maybe at the end of the second year, they just don't give you a renewal. So you have to go somewhere else. Some of those occur on a regular basis. That complicates some of the calculations.
This particular town of Franklin, what is the breakdown in the elections? Is this more of a Republican or Democratic town with the voting?
At least based upon the 2020 results, if I recall, Trump lost by 1,000 votes or so. I can go look the numbers. I know I have the numbers on my page. We did have our highest population turnout, but by percent, it was actually less than the 2016 election. We had 86% turnout for 2016. We had only 83% or thereabouts for the 2020 election. We will have a local election in November. So the 9 town councilors, 7 school committee, town clerk, and there's a couple of other board positions, board of assessors, planning board, things of that sort. Those are all up for election this year. We'll be lucky if we get more than 15 to 20% turnout for that.
Thank you.
Certainly. And as an aside, related to that piece, that's one of the things that I enjoy and I deliberately do, is I don't do politics, party politics. Town business is nonpartisan. So I avoid the political issues of that. There are town politics, no denying that. And I'll cover that. You know, why do they want this? Why do they want that? I'll cover that. But the party politics, I tend to avoid that. Unfortunately, especially the way based on what we're all seeing in DC with the logjam between the Republicans and Democrats, their decisions do have a trickle-down effect to us, to state funding and, you know, COVID funding and all that stuff. I have to cover some of that, but I tend to try and avoid as much of the party politics as I can.
Good for you.
I was going to say, you're
it's a challenge.
Yes.
You're a wise man, Steve.
It's a challenge.
Steve, I just had a question. We've lived in Franklin for about 5.5 years now. And since we moved here, there's always a water ban.
Yes.
Has Franklin always had water bans?
In my time here, and that's one of the topics that I think I mentioned, I talked with the water supervisor and water superintendent. There's a permit from the state that governs how much we can pump from our wells. We have supply. Assuming drought aside, we have enough supply. But the permit forces us to do the water conservation measures. So yes, some people call it a ban, but it's not really a ban. It's just once a week you can do your external watering. If we do get into a drought situation, then there's further restrictions, but that's based upon the drought situation. But for the foreseeable future, that water conservation measure will continue. It will never go away. If anything, and I think the phrasing of the, I think it was the assistant superintendent at the time, he said, we're all familiar with regulations. How many of those actually lessen? They always increase. So, yeah, it's for the foreseeable future, there will be a water conservation. Now, on the plus side, as I mentioned, we do have enough water, drought aside. And the calculation also includes the projected growth. So there's, quote, some conversation specifically amongst the social media saying, how come we're building? Stop building. We don't have enough water. We can't even do it. They take that into account. That's covered. We can build. We can continue to build. And guess what? Even if we continue to build, they're going to do the same thing. They're going to still have the same restriction we have. The primary reason for the restriction, one, is as a general rule, water conservation overall needs to be watched. We're unique to the extent that we're the largest groundwater use in the state of Massachusetts. All of our drinking water comes from the aquifers we sit on. No other community takes as much from the ground as we do. So it's really important how we use that water and manage the stormwater and manage the wastewater, because ultimately it goes back into the ground. And I think in, without beating the dead horse in terms of listening to the podcast, that was one of the key reasons why I wanted to talk with the water superintendents. We sat for, I think it was an hour and a half, an hour, 40 minutes. And I got all those questions answered. So we'll be able to do boom, boom, boom. And we'll be able to listen to them and then go back and say, oh, that's why. Oh, that's why. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's going to be here for a while.
Okay, thank you.
Certainly. It's an ongoing question. It's not a simple solution, but it's going to be here.
Well, we've been lucky this summer with the rain and being able to water the gardens. And
absolutely. Yeah, because if you recall, we were in a drought two status in February and March, because we didn't have a whole lot of snow cover in the winter. We didn't have the runoff to refill. So until we got that 8 inches of rain in that first week of July, we were still in doo-doo. So
right.
Now we're flush, so to speak, no pun intended.
Oh. I know I had gotten a rain barrel and like a couple days before I left, and yeah, didn't get the opportunity to hook it up before I left. And right. I'm like, it would have been full. So
overfull.
Overfull, yeah.
Overfull, yes. Yes, indeed. Yeah, so good questions, and that's why we do this. Is as I showed at the beginning, I just have a few key current topics, and then whatever questions you hear, whatever questions you have, we just simply answer and have a conversation, because there is a whole lot going on.
It's a good town.
It is. That's yeah. True.
It's, as I said, it's not perfect, but it certainly is a good place. We've enjoyed it. Two kids went through high school, through college there, also because of home situation. One's in Dedham raising their family. The other one's in an apartment in Worcester servicing their work from there. They can't afford to live here. So that's one of the issues we have to address.
I don't think if people probably didn't hear this yet, but next month we are going to be in person doing a hybrid. So you can join us on August 26th at the Franklin Senior Center. And we will still send a Zoom link out. So you have your choice of being in person or online.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. So we'll play with a funky little device called the owl. It's cool when it boots, it goes, ooh, ooh. So it'll sit on the table in the middle of the room, has a 360 camera. So for those who are coming in on Zoom, we'll still see them. And then anybody, it also has, I think it's 8 speakers. So as it hears people talking around the room, there'll be a window, so it'll focus on that person speaking. It's really neat technology, and I don't have to do anything. Just plug it in and it works. It's great.
You never say that about technology. You just cursed yourself. You're gonna go there and plug it in, and there's no hoot gonna happen.
Cables, you know, and the bag of tricks. I was there yesterday for the senior writers group when we used the camcorder, the owl cam. But you know how they have the big TV on the wheels? The HDMI cable wasn't with the TV. It had gone with the laptop, and it was with Paul's laptop. So they had to go query. I had mine as a backup in my bag. I didn't want to take it out because then I'd forget it.
Yeah, you would. I know. If you're ever missing a cable, definitely check with Paul.
Check with Paul. Right. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Ariel and Steve, I have to sign off, but thank you very much. And I'll look forward to future meetings.
Excellent. Thank you for joining us, Linda.
Bye.
Yep. Last Thursday in August.
Thank you.
Yes. Enjoy. So unless you've got anything else, we can at least stop the recording. Mm-hmm.
I've got just a quick question.
Sure.
Question for Ariel. Is the Sunshine Club still on schedule for September?
Yes, it is. Yep. I have the I have the committee, the supportive day committee, looking over all of the paperwork to get to approve the new packets to go out. I have a wait list, simply called a wait list because the program's not running now, of about 20 people that I'll be sending packets out to. And then we're gonna do, you know, intakes and assessments and all of that. And the goal is, I think September 7th is our target start date, the Tuesday after Labor Day.
Labor Day.
Super. Yeah. Let me know if you need help getting things set up.
I definitely will, thank you. If you haven't gotten your query done, then stop by and fill it out so Aaron can do that. And we're setting up the CPR training now for all of our volunteers, because that has to happen as well, so.
Oh, okay. We had done that a year or so ago. That's no good, I have to do it again?
It expires every 2 years, and believe it or not, it expires in September this year. Yep,
it's okay. 2 years,
because we were gone for that 16 months, so.
That's the one thing that happens with the pandemic. Everybody's lost the year. So it's like, where?
Yes.
Yeah. We're looking into offering hands-only CPR training, but it doesn't come with a certification card. So we need to know if that is acceptable, since that's actually what people are moving towards, is the hands-only. We just need to get the okay to do that. And that's a 2-hour versus a 4-hour class. So way easier to schedule.
Sure. One of the pandemic adjustments in process.
It is. Yes. Well, yeah. And hands only, I think, is probably a better route to go anyway. So,
you know, it's as an aside, clearly, given a number of other factors, this may be the one pandemic, but we're probably, unfortunately, this is not the last.
No, it's not. And I'm really hoping that we just don't kick back into a another wave as it seems to be going. They just, I told you earlier, they just reinstated the mask mandate here where I am. So, hearing a lot of people that are vaccinated are getting the Delta
breakthroughs.
They're not getting as sick, but they are spreading it. So all those folks that are not vaccinated, it's going to be a rough go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
A lot of controversy on people not wanting to get the the shots at all.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is
and
true.
Most of the controversy, it was a report out. A study had been done linking back to 12 particular people that via Facebook and Twitter and Instagram were the sources of the misinformation that then people just spread and spread and spread. And it's, mm-hmm. it's unfortunate, but that's the way the world is.
Yep.
Yep.
If people wouldn't turn to social media for their scientific information, it would go a lot farther mm-hmm. with educating yourself. But
yep.
My personal opinion on that.
Yes. Yes. Trust the science. And science is a process of getting to the truth. It's the mm-hmm. process.
Well, this is another part of the problem. I mean, you keep hearing criticism of Fauci and some of these other scientists. I was in infectious disease. I worked at Zeptometrics until I retired. And this was new. This was not AIDS. This was a totally different thing.
Absolutely.
And they made decisions based on the information at that point in time. And as they became more knowledgeable, they changed their opinions.
Absolutely. And
that's the way science works.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, I think the culture, particularly with the media's help, mainstream media, of which I'm certainly a part of, but I try not to behave like they do. They're going for the short story. They're going for the hot, for the quick tip. And
of course,
the devil's in the details. You can't bring that to just 140 characters. There's details.
But as they say, science is not totally scientific.
Well,
that's what we're living with.
Yeah.
So it could have been worse.
It could have. We're not at it yet. So just.
Yeah.
No, we're not.
Nope, no, not yet.
We'll just behave and set a good example for others, hopefully follow.
That's right.
Exactly.
We're lucky, though, that we live in a country where we have a lot of shots available. And you go to some of these other countries like Haiti or some of the African countries where they don't even get an opportunity to get a shot there, and they perish.
Yes.
Right.
Just by total default, by living there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's another whole equity situation. Yeah, it's just, it's sad.
Mm-hmm. I mean, even across this country. That's
where the World Health Organization comes into play, and they just don't have the capacity to treat them all.
Yeah.
That's their charter. They take care of the third world countries, but they don't have enough. They just don't have enough vaccine.
No, vaccines. Well, and in order to get the vaccines, they need funding. And didn't some country just take away the funding at one point in time? Probably a critical period. So, you know, yeah, not good. Not good.
Mm-hmm. Nope. Yeah, well,
I've lived overseas and saw so much poverty that I'm used to seeing so much poverty that when I come to this country and I'm in this country, I thank God that my parents were able to afford to send me to private school and to college.
Mm-hmm.
And I became a US citizen. But I have to tell you that having traveled to a lot of poor countries, I won't go there anymore, because to go and stay at a nice hotel and then walk out in the streets and see the people in the streets starving and wanting your money, and you can't give it all to them.
Yeah.
It's a sad commentary.
It is.
It is. That's true.
Yep. It is. Well, thank you all for participating. I will stop the recording.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.